It's good to be here with you this morning, here at Life Fellowship, I think it is, right? Life Church. And been looking forward to this time. I think back to 2 years ago and visited here when some of my family and I were involved in Core One, and just appreciated the sense, the spirit that I sensed in this place. Yeah, regarding the book, it is in the back. I think Mark laid it out back there. Most of what you hear me share this week can be found in this book. And it's a bit of a biographical sketch of my late wife, Rachel. And she was tragically killed in a car accident 3.5 years ago. Almost 3.5 years ago. And up to that point, I'd always wanted to someday write a book about the church. But I really never felt like I should be at least 40 before I would do that. And then I turned 40 and I thought maybe it should be at least 50. And anyhow, then after Rachel was taken home to be with the Lord, I thought, you know, I really should write a book about her. And somebody said, I don't think it was my idea, but somebody said, well, maybe it's the same book. You can take just the picture of who she was as your bride and draw a parallel to what the bride of Christ should be like. And so that's really what the book was born out of. Each chapter begins with a little section called Rachel's Story, and so that's where the sketch part. It's certainly not an exhaustive story of her life, but each chapter is introduced by a little piece of her story. And then the next section of each chapter is some of her inspiration, how she inspired others, some of her own writings. And then the third section of each chapter is simply titled The Bride of Christ. That's where we try to draw some parallel. And primarily it's teaching about the church, the Bride of Christ. And then the fourth section of each chapter, and this format follows the whole way through the book, is simply called Reflections in Marriage. And it's kind of a boring read if you just read it in here, because it's basically a sermon outline and with a few more details. But it was always one of Rachel's favorite sermons that I would preach, not because we had a perfect marriage, but primarily I think it was because of the closing illustration that I would use on that sermon. And I won't tell you what it is. I might use it later this week as we close out the week. And then the final section of each chapter is simply how-tos for couples. And that was born out of both the time I was writing the book, a couple young men, one just newly married, another maybe married 10 years or so, came to me within days of each other and said, asked me, how do I connect with my wife's heart? And at first it was kind of like, oh my, that's a deep, profound question. I'm not sure if I can ever quite answer that. And by the way, the last point in that section is called The Mystery of It All. About the time you think you have that figured out, then it's all different. So it's all a mystery. And the key is just keep looking. Keep on the journey. Keep trying to discover. Keep pursuing your wife. Anyways, I just hardly without thinking, then I just said, "Well, I really think just make her happy. If you can figure out what makes your wife happy, I think you'll have her heart." Anyways, that's probably way too simple, and all of these counselors sitting up here probably already wondering about me. But what if she wants a $500,000 limousine? You married her. Anyway, if you go on Amazon or Westbow Press website, you can buy this book for $14.99. But if you buy it this week, you can have it for $10. Okay? Is that a deal? So you can talk to, you can figure that out with Mark. I'm not going to worry about the money part of it. I didn't write the book to make money. I just simply wrote the book because I felt God wanted me to. And so hope you'll be blessed. I noticed on the little flyer that Doug sent to me last week that you were calling these revival meetings. And I was okay with that, I guess. And then you called me Evangelist Ernest. I thought, ooh, I have a new role I need to fill. But then I thought about, you know, yeah, I don't mind being an evangelist. That's really why we're in Los Angeles. I remember Gary Troyer, when we were in MTC training, he looked over my scores as, what was it called, kind of a temperament, spiritual gifts, I guess, analysis. He said, "I'm not sure why you're in Los Angeles. You're not a missionary. You're not a evangelist." And anyways, so I was going through a real crisis. Man, here I moved all the way to Los Angeles and I shouldn't even be there. But I remembered a quote from the Sotera twins. I don't know how many of you remember the two twin brothers that were perhaps still in revival ministry in Canada. They had come through Minnesota there several times. Ralph and Lou Sotera, identical twins, filled with the Holy Spirit and used powerfully of God in revival throughout Canada and the U.S. But they said, and you can write this down. By the way, I don't have a worksheet for you this morning, so you may just want a blank sheet of paper. I have worksheets for you the rest of the time, I think. But you may want to write this down. One of them, I forget if it was Ralph or Lou, said, "Evangelism without revival is like holding a newborn baby up to the breast of a dead corpse." And I remember being so repulsed by that illustration. But I really believe it's true. You know, you can say goodbye to evangelism, or at least about lasting renewal, if there's not real revival happening in the body of Christ, in your own heart. So I'm sure Life Church, with that name, doesn't want to be a dead corpse. And so you have revival meetings. And I'm sure, sensing the spirit of worship here already this morning, that you do have revival taking place. I wasn't in Lancaster County long this time until I heard about the youth presentation of Ben-Hur. Just, yeah, and like the whoever it was up here said, I think it was a smashing success, if you can say that, in the spirit of humility. I think it was. And when you have the young people in your church doing those kind of things, you're on a good track. And probably an oversimplification again, but I really think young people are a reflection of their parents. And so I think you have some good parents. God bless you. Can't help but be here with Mark, and I realize Mark's kind of on a sabbatical or something, but do you mind if I share this story about the time I shared some tea with you in the dorm at Maranatha? This will kind of show my age a little bit maybe, but Mark was probably about 22 years old, something like that, maybe not even that old. And he was a student at Maranatha Bible School, and I was there as, Rachel and I were there as dean of men and women. And our last responsibility at the end of every day was to make sure everybody was in bed sleeping at night in the dorms. And Mark's getting nervous already. And so I was making my rounds. Of course, we always did this with the lights out. And it could get kind of dangerous walking around through the dorm without lights on. And but I had a cup of tea that Rachel had made for me, and so I didn't want to separate from that. So I was carrying this cup of tea through the dark dorm. And fortunately, there was some moonlight coming in the big plate windows there. And I was just standing back in the back corner, just kind of quietly listening to see if everybody was sleeping. And I heard some whispering going on over here in this one corner. So I made my way over there. And came in here was two Slabaughs together. And I don't even think they're related, but Mark Slabaugh and Matthew Slabaugh from Seney, Michigan. I'm not even sure where he lives these days, but they were visiting. It wasn't ruckus. It wasn't anything. It was just this quiet little whisper. And so I went over and kind of stood close to their bunk for a while, and they didn't know I was there. And after a while, I kind of stepped right into their conversation and said, "Hey, would you like a sip of tea?" Oh, we didn't know you were here. And, "Sure, yeah, we'll take a sip of tea." And so one of them took a sip of tea, and the other one took a sip of tea. And then I went, I think I said something about maybe going to sleep or something. And next morning, Mark came to me at breakfast, and he said, "What did you have in that tea?" He said, "I just went right to sleep after that." Well, I think we're probably running past time to get started here. Here this morning, I'd like to begin this week with saying something about family systems. And I don't know much. I just am here on a journey, and I've lived some life, and been part of my own family, and I married Rachel, and she came from a family, and then I should also give credit where credit is due. Probably one of the most impactful influences in Rachel and my life as parents was through a series done by Dr. Marlon Howe with Hope for the Family. And so I kind of talk his theory without even realizing it much. My children will tell you that. By the way, it's good to have Karita here today. Anyways, family systems. He says that families' systems are like a hanging mobile. You know how they come down from strings and, you know, and if you touch them on one side, they kind of exaggerate over here, and they just kind of fit whatever. That's how family systems are. They're influenced by the different parts in the system. So But it has so much to do. It was so helpful to Rachel and I to discover who we were, where we came from, why we are the way we are, and then how do you blend those two together? So, how we get to be who we are. I'd like to begin here in Psalm 68. I thought about reading the whole chapter, the whole psalm, but it's a fairly long psalm. There's a number of verses in the psalm that I like, but I'm just going to focus on this one. Where in the King James it says, God setteth the solitary in families. He bringeth out those which are bound with chains, but the rebellious dwell in a dry land. The Message puts it a little more bluntly. God makes homes for the homeless, leads prisoners to freedom, but leaves rebels to rot in hell. And in a way, this verse kind of encaptures, I think, what I want to talk about today. All of us are in a family, and we really had nothing to do with it. We just showed up one day, and there's where we were, exactly where God wanted us to be. And it would be nice if those were perfect families. It would have been nice to have been Cain or Abel or maybe Seth. Because God made Adam and Eve, right? So, seems like that would have been a perfect family, but as we know, even that first family was not perfect. So we're born into these systems, and so then we have these ways about us that just kind of are handed to us, some of it genetically, no doubt, but much of it by example and just by influence. We're taught to be Whitmers or Schraders or whoever we are. And with that comes many good things, and with it some not so good stuff. So what do we do with that? Do we just try to deny it and defend it? Say, hey, we're normal, everybody else is abnormal. And how does that work in marriage? If you have two normal people coming together and everybody else is abnormal, that would mean, I think my wife's abnormal, right? She thinks I'm abnormal, which was the case, pretty much. Either we can recognize our bondage, we can recognize our issues and our problems and come to the Lord with them, and He will lead us like prisoners to freedom. We feel bound by chains, the King James says. You know, this is just kind of who we are. This is the way the Whitmers are. And sometimes we defend ourselves that way. Well, you know, it's just kind of the way I am. I was born this way. All Whitmers are this way. And so, I mean, don't, you know, get over it. Or we can simply recognize this and bring it to God and say, what do you want to do with this? And if we don't, if we opt not to and just defend ourselves and say, well, this is who we are, you know, and this can be said about not just domestic families, but this could be said about church families. You know, we develop characteristics as a church, and you know, we're the ones that have it all together, you know, or denominations, or we can embrace our issues, bring them to God, and He will lead us to freedom. And if we don't, we will simply rot in hell. That's the fact. We'll dwell in a very dry land. No system, no family system is perfect. I've already talked about that, so let's just relax. None of us are perfect. I'm not perfect. I'm on a journey. Got a lot to learn yet. And I think you do too. But they're very fascinating. Better yet to experience. I enjoyed my family system. especially when I thought it was perfect. You know, it wasn't until I got a little older that I realized, man, oh, maybe something's wrong here. And then it was especially intriguing when I got married. Ah, there's another way of doing things. There's another way of... I remember the first time I taught school in northern Minnesota for a number of years. In fact, that's where Rachel and I started dating. And it was sometime in that she was teaching at Black Duck, those of you that know Minnesota. I was in International Falls, which is where we ended up living for many years. And I would drive down to Black Duck and have a date with Rachel and every other week. And one time her family came up to see her from Freeport, Illinois. They were farmers, and so they were busy, hardworking people, and when they travel, they didn't want to waste good prime daytime just driving, and so they would drive through the night. Most of their traveling was done at nighttime, and or they'd, you know, 24 hours straight or whatever, to, if it was far enough. And so here they were, the Schraders were all tired out one morning when I was there, and they were in the shack there where Clovis and Miriam used to live, and all scattered out on the living room floor, just laying there, you know. I had never seen a family do that before. I mean, the Whitmers, when we laid down, we were on a bed in the bedroom. That's where we laid down. And so it was just intriguing to me. It was just like, wow, you mean it's okay to just kind of relax and hang out and snore a little bit even on the living room floor? And as my kids would tell you, I learned that pretty good, because in our life, Rachel and my family, I probably spent more time on the living room floor than I did on the couch, either reading books to the kids or taking a nap or whatever. So it's intriguing. We love to experience those new things from each other. We're all involved in at least three family systems. My dad's family, okay, the Norman Whitmer, he came from a family. So we had his family system. My mom's family system, she was a Schrader, Ron and Mariana Schrader. And of course, there were systems, they each had systems ahead of them, but that's directly who, I'm sorry, my mom's family, I'm talking about Rachel now. My mom was a Hershey. And so she had there was a Whitmer system, there was the Hershey system. And when you want to talk about systems, you just talk about the Hershey system. Any other Hersheys here? Oh, here's one. I wonder. I have to meet you. Anyways, I see you've survived so far. And then there's the one that they've together created for me. Okay, so Norman Whitmer came together with Anna Hershey, and they created an immediate family system where I showed up. Okay? So we're all involved. Even if you're not married, you're involved in these three family systems. And some of them may be broken and dysfunctional. And maybe it's almost like you have two immediate family systems if your parents are separated or whatever. Or if there's remarriage or whatever. And that's complicates it even more. But it doesn't subtract from God's grace and His beauty when we come to Him with our systems, with our stuff. So then if we get married, we embrace, or hopefully we should embrace, still three more family systems. And I would suggest that it's incumbent upon us as men, as husbands, as leaders, and I'm assuming I'm talking to a group of people that recognize that. Now, there would be some settings where I would get into all kinds of trouble by suggesting that, but we'll assume that here. I think it's incumbent upon us to embrace, I need to embrace Rachel's family system if I expect her to embrace mine. And so let be a leader. Let me deal with my issues, look at my issues, salvage the good and challenge the bad. My spouse, Rachel, had a father. He was a Schrader. Actually, he wasn't a Schrader. He was a Peterson. But he was his father was a Peterson that was adopted by Schraders. Our spouse's mother, so Rachel's mother, Graybill family from Indiana. She had those two systems, and then, of course, the system that her parents created for her. So now we're both, Rachel and I both, are involved in six different family systems here. We're going to make a marriage work. That's why in-laws matter, because family systems matter. And when we marry someone, we need to embrace, we need to accept who they are. And it matters. Now, it shouldn't matter more than it should, but it matters. All systems are good, and all systems have their issues. They're all redeemable. Good stuff happens. And so it's exciting, it really is. And all of you who are married know that. Recently, I was at the Santa Ana airport where we had put some of these books, and these are not a bestseller on Choice Book Displays, in case you're wondering. Marriage books don't tend to in general, but anyways, I was talking to the one of the clerks there at the store, and so the first time around, I noticed none of the books had sold. I thought, well, maybe I need to start talking about these books, okay? And so I was, as I go from store to store, I'd say, did you happen to notice this book? You know, and I usually don't promote myself like that, but I thought, well, maybe for Choice Book's sake, I should, you know. She said, yeah, I saw it over there. I figured it was something about marriage. You know, I just came through a 7-year relationship, and I don't want anything to do with marriage. And so many people experience those kinds of things in relationships. And I said, oh, that's too bad. And I told her the story behind the book, and I said, you know, I said, marriage is awesome. I said, yeah, I said, it's challenging. But when you do it God's way, I said, there's a lot of good things can happen. And so she said she's going to buy the book. So I think I was effective that time, but we'll see when I go back whether she bought the book. So the family system then that Rachel and I create, or that you and your husband wife create for your family, is the seventh family system. So family systems matter. These are just some observations. I'm just talking here. You can correct me anytime. You can even interrupt me. I'll give you time if you have something you want to say or challenge or correct. By the way, I was going to say something about the brother that was up here at the beginning when he was right ahead of everything else, even before we went to Sunday school. I forget. Who was that? There you are. Thank you. He challenged the children. He said something about, you know, so if you hear God speaking to you, you know, just say yes. You know, don't say no. And later I was thinking, you know, he really shouldn't have just told the children that. He really should have told all of us that as adults. You know, we never want to say no to God. In fact, twice in the Psalms, there's a verse that kind of repeats itself, and it says, the fool hath said in his heart, there is no God. And I understand in the Hebrew, and I don't know Hebrew, but I'm told this, that if that were more transliterated, it would be, the fool hath said in his heart, no God. And we don't want to be fools. We want to be wise people saying yes to God, especially when it comes to family systems and helping ourselves get out of the tangles that we're in. We want to just be all yes to God. And it reminds me of a little chorus that we sing often back in our little fellowship in Los Angeles. I say yes, yes, yes. We don't want to be fools. We want to say yes. I'm going to sing that for you. I'm going to sing it through one time because it's probably not what you think it is. And then you help me sing it. And let's just make that commitment right here at the onset. that we're going to be saying yes to God this week. I say yes, yes, yes. I say yes, yes, yes. I say yes, Lord. I say yes, Lord. I say yes, yes, yes. Sing it with me now. I say yes, yes, yes. I say yes, yes, yes. I say yes, Lord. I say yes, Lord. I say yes, yes, yes.
One more time, you can get some four-part harmony in there, being Mennonites, I think it's here. Let's sing that one more time, and at the end, let's raise our hands if you're willing. We're going to give the invitation at the front end. You know, God's the only one that we should give a blank sheet of paper to and sign it at the bottom and let Him fill it in later. You never want to do that to anyone else. But to God, you can. You can already sign your name. I'm going to say yes to everything that you put on here. So let's sing this again.
I say yes, yes, yes. I say yes, yes, yes. I say yes, Lord. I say I say yes, yes, yes.
I'd like to read a little section from the book here on the how-tos for couples. I have, I think it's 6 points here. And then the seventh point is the mystery one. I'm going to be reading on this family. This comes along with the marriage. It was the second set of three systems I embraced when marrying Rachel. It came with her. I didn't just get her, but I got her family systems too. And what mattered most is that I really needed to get it. I needed to understand her family and fully appreciate who they were and what made them tick. I needed to learn why they think the way they do, what their history was as a family, and how they got to be who they are. Rachel was a product of these systems, and if I was asking her to marry me and my systems, I also needed to marry hers. She was willing to embrace my family system, and I needed to embrace hers too. In fact, I would suggest it's more incumbent upon me to embrace her family system before expecting her to embrace mine. As a whole, it was a fun experience. Oh, I think I won't go over that. I told you that experience. Of course, some systemic issues coming both ways from our families of origin were more challenging than finding out how to lay on the living room floor. And as typical human beings, it would have been easier if the other would change, not? But if we self-evaluate at all, our observations about our own family systems and those of others should teach us something about ourselves, like a hanging mobile. We tend to make room for ourselves and accommodate our own ways quite fluidly, but we find it much more difficult to accommodate and make room for others. You see, we all see ourselves as normal, but everyone else is abnormal. And the more different they are from us, the more abnormal they seem. But over the years, Rachel and I found that if we were truly honest about our own systemic weaknesses and were committed to growth and health within the family system we were creating for our kids, it was a win-win for everyone. Obviously, as our kids can tell you, we still didn't get it right. We still didn't get it perfect. But we at least ironed out a few wrinkles, probably created a few others. But that'll be our children's responsibility. Figure that out. No, it's ours too. I've often wondered since Rachel's death why the Lord saw fit to take her home at the critical point in time that he did. Perhaps it was because he wanted her life on this earth to end at its zenith of happiness. She was so excited about her whole family arriving in Canyon City for the wedding. Not only were all of our children converging there for Asher and Teresa's wedding that weekend, but her parents were coming, and most of her siblings too. She was a very happy lady. So she went from the zenith of happiness here on earth to the ultimate epitome of happiness in heaven, to be not only with other family members who'd gone before, but altogether forever with Jesus. The rest of us, well, we're not quite there yet, but we're on the way. So I would like to suggest here, and again, I think I'm in a safe environment where I can do this, that, and this comes from Dr. Marlon Howe. He says that the father and mother are the primary relationship in every family system, and I think you would agree with that. He calls it a 3+ relationship. This should be the strongest and also most intimate relationship in the whole family. And then there is the mother-son, father-daughter relationship. That he calls a 2+ relationship. It's a relationship, it's a favored relationship. Not in the sense of there being favorites, but there's a natural camaraderie within those relationships. Little boys always want to grow up to be like daddy. If dad's a truck driver, your little boy is going to be driving trucks by the time he's 2 years old. Or if he's a carpenter or whatever, he wants to be like daddy. The same way with girls and their mothers. They want to be like mommy and whatever she is and is doing. So it's kind of a favored relationship. And then there's the father-daughter relationship and the mother-son relationship. That he calls a 1+ relationship. But it's a relationship of fondness. It's not favored like between the same sexes, but there's a fondness there, kind of a specialness in a way. And this comes about because when the little boy sees how wonderful dad treats mom and just how much he loves mom, and that's why fathers and mothers really need to major on this relationship and let it be known. You save some things for the bedroom, but I think way too many times our children don't see our affection. They need to see. I wish Rachel and I would have expressed that more publicly, right? So our kids would see it and hear it. But when the son sees dad relating to mom, he says, you know, that's really pretty neat. That's pretty special. Wow. And when the daughter sees mom relating to dad, she says, wow, he must be a pretty cool dude. Because, you know, mom, I really like mom and she really likes him. You know? And I like the story that Floyd Miller told at Ted and Rose's wedding years ago from Indiana about the old hermit that lived up in the mountain and just with his son. Somehow he had separated from his wife and he lived up in the mountain all by himself with his son. And he never liked to go down into the village any more than he had to because he just couldn't get along with people. And so they'd stay up there until they absolutely had to, and then they'd come down to the village and go to the grocery store and get a few eggs and whatever they needed and hurry back up into the mountain. And one time when they were down in the village, they went to this grocery store, and here there were some girls in this grocery store. And the boy said,
Dad, what are those?
And just some geese. There's some geese. And they hurried on his way and they headed back up the mountain. And halfway up the mountain, the little boy said, Dad, could I have one of those geese? Now, it really kind of breaks down with what I've been saying, because obviously the dad wasn't having a very good relationship with his mom, or they'd be together. But still, there was something fascinating to that little boy about what should be going on. So, I would love to entertain discussion over an illustration like this. I'm sure you would have a lot more to say. And what time is it? Is there a clock here? What time am I supposed to be done? I'm supposed to have done, right? Okay. Some simple observations. I pretty much went over this. I just say at the end there. Whoops, what am I doing here? This here. And I know this doesn't answer all the questions, the same-sex issues, but I think when the family system gets out of sync, we create potential for confusion. And this whole maleness, femaleness things, born out of the image of God. God is both male and female. He expresses both. That's how we learn how to love and how we learn how to exercise authority. We have... God is transcendent, at the same time he's very personal, very immanent, separate but belonging, powerful but relational, sovereign but supportive, all-knowing but very feeling, producing, reproducing. And I just love this little children's song. We have a great, big, wonderful God who illustrates the masculinity of God. But at the same time, this other song, Jesus loves me, this I know, little ones to him belong, just expresses the immanence of God. And God is both. And the wonderful thing about marriage, and I really believe that's why God designed marriage, is it brings all of God together in a couple, in a marriage. And so when that marriage functions as it should, our kids see God. Religions can get lopsided. I don't know where your religion is in this. I don't know which side Mennonites would be on. But we have, on the one hand, we can have performance-based religions without love, truth without love. On the other hand, we can have emotion-based religions where there's love without truth. And Scripture says when it comes to speaking, we should speak the truth in love. We should have both. Love without truth is less than real love. Truth without love is less than real truth. Same way with our temperaments, and this is more where it comes with the family. We want to be balanced in it all. Well, I think I should wrap it up here. Thank you. Hopefully we've generated some thoughts, not only in your head, but deep in your heart, and wherever you find yourself in life, I hope you're open to saying yes to God.